Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is the fourth largest economy in the world, but that prideful headline is challenged by a grim reality. A homeless population that far surpasses any other state, accounting for half of the country's unhoused population. Experiencing homelessness touches each and every one of us. It is a crisis Governor Gavin Newsom has devoted an unprecedented amount of investment towards, even preceding his time as governor. But Newsom is beginning his second term with a larger unhoused population since he first took office. And our next guest spent time understanding how his legacy as governor and path forward in the Democratic Party hinge on Governor Newsom making visible headway on California's homelessness crisis. Angela Hart is a senior reporter with Kaiser Health News, a national newsroom that produces in-depth journalism about health issues. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning.
Okay, so your reporting is on the one hand really taking stock of Governor Newsom's investment into solving this crisis of homelessness in his first term, as well as the stakes if he doesn't make significant progress. What went into finding the connection between homelessness and Newsom's political ambitions?
Absolutely. So, Gavin Newsom has really made homelessness, I would say, if not the top, a top priority. Since he took office in 2019, and it's really interesting, this issue, politically speaking, has really dogged him since he ran his first county supervisor campaign in San Francisco on homelessness 2 decades ago. And so I think to look at both the policy that he's spearheading with his unprecedented investment as governor, can't really be separated from the political reality that this is someone who really has kind of taken the mantle of homelessness as a key issue for him, really dating back. And it's interesting because homelessness really, it's not the job of the governor of California to, you know, pump billions of dollars into homelessness, yet here he is doing it. And it's really complicated because politically, because if you look at, on one hand, him really kind of taking this issue as his own, really owning it, really kind of forcing the boundaries of state government in terms of tackling it. But there's a really immense political liability, perhaps. I mean, it's really difficult for someone with his position and the Democratic Party to say, look, I'm taking on this issue like no one else has. Yet, look, the situation is getting worse than ever. So it's a real political liability for him. One, by the way, that he is not running away from.
Yeah. I mean, when you say that, you know, as a governor, I mean, this is unprecedented. Did governors of the past really devote a lot of investment towards this issue, or was it more a local issue?
I think you really see the governor making a big splash here. Newsom often talks about Governor Jerry Brown, who preceded him, as really, I mean, I think half a billion dollars, $500 million was the biggest investment that the state had made previously. Past governors really have not taken on this issue, and it is fundamentally a local city and county responsibility. So contrast the investment under Governor Brown, who really did rely on the locals to really, take charge of this issue, with my analysis showed $18.4 billion during the governor's first term. And that's only going to increase this year with a couple more billion dollars. So around $21 billion is expected by the end of this year.
Yeah, so it is increasing, and it's significantly more than the half billion that was devoted by Governor Brown. Given that Governor Newsom has really put his stake in the ground on a variety of liberal or even progressive issues, from climate goals to reproductive rights, gender-affirming care, immigration, guns, and race. I mean, that's really a wide canvas that kind of sticks it to conservative leaders in the country, other conservative governors. Where does homelessness fit into this larger message of Governor Newsom's ideals?
I would say the cultural issues that you talked about, Newsom really, I mean, he grabs those and he is unafraid in terms of, you know, prodding Republican states and conservative politicians. This issue is really kind of both. I mean, this opens Newsom up to criticism from those very Republican and conservative leaders. It's a little more difficult for him to say, look, we're progressive. I'm tackling this issue as a progressive issue. Meanwhile, the numbers are increasing. The level of health crises are increasing. The public health threats are increasing. Public anger is boiling over. And so the governor has a really difficult task ahead of him in his next 4 years, really trying to explain to the public, look, we are doing more than California ever has. And look, it's going to take time. And that's really, I think, what the administration's perspective is. Newsom often rails that politicians, not only past state politicians, but local leaders run from this issue because it's so politically difficult. And if when you hear him talking about it, you know, his nose flares, his, you know, it gets heated and pounds his arms up and down. I mean, he really is impassioned by this issue. And I think the way that he has really owned it, again, going back to his time as mayor of San Francisco, really does force him to like do things that haven't been tried, to put more pressure on those who are carrying out homeless policy in a way that really has never been done before.
I remember when covering his State of the State address like 3 years ago, he devoted his entire State of the State to the issue of homelessness. And that's not typically what a State of the State is. It's usually a variety of priorities that you want to accomplish in the year. And he just devoted the entire address to homelessness. You also talk about this historic investment of, what, $18 billion, and it's only going to grow. Can you remind us some of the flagship programs and services this funding went to?
Yeah. And let me just make a real quick point on the State of the State. That was when Governor Newsom, that was his first State of the State in 2020, right a couple months before the pandemic crisis hit. And Newsom at the time said, listen, healthcare and housing can no longer be divorced. You know, we need to write prescriptions for housing, just like doctors write prescriptions for medications. And I just want to, I did an analysis at that time, and it really is a stark contrast from Governor Jerry Brown, which I listened to all eight of his State of the States, and I didn't hear the word homelessness uttered. So it's not to say that he was completely ignoring the issue, but it just shows the importance that Governor Newsom has put on this. In terms of the funding, there's really kind of, there is a lot of money going in a lot of places. There's four primary buckets, if you will. If you look at the primary, I think, strategy for tackling homelessness under Governor Newsom's ideas is really, really looking at housing. How can California fund new housing fast? And I'm not just talking about new construction. We're talking about conversions of hotels and motels, container ships, all different types of housing. So it's housing combined with supportive services, social services like mental health care, addiction treatment, job placements, financial counseling, case management, you know, intensive help for people who are living homeless and who are at risk of becoming homeless, really looking at combining those services with housing to get people indoors. That is a major problem, right? Citing those properties, citing those buildings, finding enough funding for that type of housing is really confounding a lot of the goals that the governor has. A second bucket is, this is something that Newsom is going really hard on right now, and I think it speaks to the political reality that he's facing, which is getting rid of these encampments that are proliferating across California. I've been reporting on this for years and years, and I've been all around California. I'm doing some more reporting trips this month. It's not a secret to anybody who lives in California. Encampments are everywhere. Freeway underpasses, sidewalk, city sidewalk. It's not only the urban corridors, though. If you go to rural California, I was up in the rural north last year, and along the waterways and the creeks, you know, and these kind of rural enclaves, you find these little, you know, communities of homeless people, and it just presents a different reality when people think about California. You think about San Francisco, you think about Los Angeles. No, it's everywhere here. And another primary part of that funding is really investing in behavioral health care, that is addiction and mental health care, and really looking at that as an arm of a way to get out of this crisis.
Hmm. Well, throughout your reporting, though, I mean, as we all know, the population of people in sheltered or without stable housing has just grown. How did you come to better understand why this continues to escalate despite unprecedented funding and support?
Yeah, the numbers, the federal government released some estimates, the latest estimate, and the numbers in California had gone, it's a double-digit increase since Gavin Newsom took office in 2019, around 180,000 people, although the governor, I would say, just a couple months. I mean, the governor acknowledges that that is an undercount. And it's a snapshot. It's a point in time, one day that people are counted. It really misses a lot of people. So I think that number even is, you know, does not reflect the true reality. And it's interesting. I mean, California really gets, there's a big boisterous debate of how the causes, the root causes of homelessness in California. You know, some people talk about, oh, California is drawing people from other states because it's more hospitable in terms of the weather, because it's more generous in terms of its benefits. And then, you know, if you talk to another camp of homeless advocates, they really vehemently disagree with that idea and really point to the dramatic affordable housing problem in California and extreme disparities in terms of wealth, and people are losing housing left and right. That's just true. So I think the reality is it's both. Governor Newsom's deputy chief of staff, Jason Elliott, I really, you know, kind of pushed him on this, and we had a great discussion about what is the root causes of this. And he was like, you can write a, you know, PhD thesis on this. But he did point to the factors I just talked about, weather, generous benefits, and the extraordinary cost of living. That being said, if you look across California at cities and counties, some are more welcome to accepting homeless people, not only in terms of services, but in terms of building the housing that's needed and the shelter that's needed. Other places really revolt and reject that. And that is something Governor Newsom is really trying to tackle head on as well.
So how is this shaping his approach to homelessness in his second term, given that we haven't seen visible progress?
The numbers are increasing. The severity is increasing. The governor's administration says that they've housed more than 68,000 people was the last number I got. The number of people falling into homelessness is superseding that. And so Newsom, going into his second term, really has said, listen, this is unacceptable. We need to make progress. I am tired of providing all this funding without some real accountability measures, without some real progress being shown on the ground. So I think one thing I'm paying attention to for his second term is he talks about accountability. What does that mean? It really means ratcheting up the pressure, going harder on locals, going harder in terms of public visibility. You know, the governor putting voice to this issue as much as he can publicly, but also really putting, amping up the pressure on cities and counties. Now, there is some more money coming in the budget, and we can expect state lawmakers this year to really scrutinize, is the money we're spending working, and how much more do we really need? Is it about money? Newsom's administration points out, listen, it's not just about more funding. It's also about making that money work. And I think that's where we're really going to see a lot of the policy debate this year. I think there's no question. You know, I really argue that this is the number one issue for Governor Newsom. I mean, there's a lot of other competing issues that he cares about. This is a governor who has called himself the healthcare governor. He really cares about and is writing extraordinary policy on healthcare. Of course, climate change and environmental policy. I mean, there's a number of other policies that he cares about. But when I speak to the governor's friends who have known him for decades, when I speak to his advisors, and when you actually hear him himself speak, I've gone out with him and walked the streets of San Francisco with him, you know, in the past. And there is a different tone that he has when it comes to this issue. And I think it speaks to, on one hand, like what's in his heart, if that's not corny to say. You really see his passion on it. I think it also speaks to the political reality that, you know, he's got to do something. There's no way that you can claim yourself as like a strong leader of California and look at everything we've done. Meanwhile, you have a giant liability right in your backyard. So I think that he's doing it on one hand out of practicality in terms of policy, and another hand because he really does deeply care.
I'm curious, given that Governor Newsom is obviously considered liberal and even progressive on a lot of issues, especially when compared to Republican governors like Ron DeSantis of Florida or Greg Abbott of Texas. But on the issue of homelessness, would you call the governor's approaches liberal or even progressive?
He's not liberal on this issue. I wouldn't use that term. I would say he's, you know, moderate at best. I mean, he's pouring so much money into this, and that is definitely something that we see, you know, Democratic politics. You wouldn't see I would hazard to say you would see a Republican pouring as much money into this issue. There's just different priorities and different policy approaches. But Newsom has really rallied against a lot of the liberal kind of policies and rhetoric from that political camp in California. People who have known him for years and years and worked alongside him, Democrats and progressive politicians and advocacy groups, think that he's going to he's really taking an approach that is not human. I mean, people point to the encampment issue and really criticize him for clearing these encampments. Newsom has really ratcheted up the discourse on this. The encampment issue, he is unapologetically saying, this is unacceptable. We need to get rid of these encampments. I think that speaks to the politics there a little bit, but also the health and safety problems that are there and the really like the public frustration. But Newsom is not tolerant of these. And it's interesting, mayors across California and county and city leaders are kind of echoing him. And I've interviewed many that didn't make it into my piece, but it's informed my reporting, that say the streets are not a bed. The outside is nowhere for someone to live. You have rats, you have disease, you have, you know, safety threats, you have fires, you know, when it's cold. I mean, the hot and the extreme cold in here, it's just really, people are dying on the streets. So Newsom is really going after the encampment issue, but, you know, there's nowhere to put people, the advocates point out. And in order for the approach to be more humane, they say, we need to really get more social services out into the encampments, get more funding for housing and for shelter, and be way more aggressive at moving people off the streets and actually into somewhere, rather than this revolving door of encampment to encampment. People, if you talk to people who are homeless, which I spend a lot of time in encampments, and to those people who I've spoken to, the housing and all these promises for more funding, they're not seeing it. They're just shuffling from one encampment to the other, trying to stay away from, you know, getting arrested or getting, you know, getting moved by code enforcement officials.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for your deep dive.
Thank you.
Angela Hart is a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A first-of-its-kind training program at a Sacramento County prison is helping women learn how to brew coffee and, in turn, change lives for the better. Redemption Coffee at Rio Cosumnes Correctional Center, or RCCC, is a unique program for women with the goal of helping reduce the odds of reoffending by preparing students to thrive in the coffee industry. We sat down with Jamie Mason, Redemption Coffee's program director and legend Highwater, an alumna of the program who now works as a roaster, who shared how this program trains students in specialty coffee and connects them with community partners in the industry. Well, Jamie and Legend, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Jamie, I want to start with you because this really began with you. If you can start off by sharing your background in the coffee industry and how this led to you leading Redemption Coffee at Rio Cosumnes Correctional Center.
Well, I started in coffee in 1995 and kind of just fell in love with it right away and worked for different companies throughout my career as a barista. And being a barista, that's hard on your body sometimes. So I decided to start taking classes wherever I could, going to what we call in the industry cuppings and learning how to taste coffee and recognize different tasting notes, I guess. And I had great mentors that kind of guided me through the coffee industry and kind of what to do next. And I started with Bewley's couple years before the pandemic, I was traveling around. And then obviously after the pandemic hit and we went on lockdown, we were no longer allowed to travel. And I was laid off. But before that, we had met with the sheriff's department. And they had talked about this program that I'm running right now, Redemption Coffee. And I was excited. So I just wanted to make sure that that was still going to be happening. So I called the lieutenant at the time and told him, I'll work for free. Let's just get this going. Don't worry. Like, I wasn't doing much of anything else. So I just kind of stumbled into the job. I think I denied it twice. Because I was afraid of failing these women. That's, I think, the biggest thing that I was afraid of. And finally, the lieutenant just wouldn't take no for an answer. And I'm certainly glad he did that.
Yeah, as I'm sure many of your students are as well. I mean, we're talking about Redemption Coffee, but also this is rebuilding a life after incarceration. Did you have a personal connection to understanding these challenges, or what gravitated you towards wanting to pursue this?
Well, I think I was incredibly ignorant to a lot of what these women have gone through in the beginning. And I had a sister who had dealt with addiction. So I think that when I finally accepted it, I was doing it for her. And then I kind of fell in love with these women I get to meet and help mentor, because there are rough waters out there and we all need a life raft sometimes. And I've had many life rafts and mentors, and I like being a life raft for another woman.
Given that there are a variety of vocational programs offered at Rio Cosumnes, I mean, you have more, I think, expected or traditional ones like culinary arts and landscaping, welding, mechanics, but there are these unique programs as well. I mean, I was learning about beekeeping, a wild horse program, and now there's a barista program. How do you describe Redemption Coffee to people?
I say we're changing lives through coffee. pretty simple, like, just like that. I think we've got some excellent vocational programs out there and excellent educators that really just strive to help the people being housed at Rio Cosumnes right now.
I was looking at photos of the cafe, and it really just looks like any trendy cafe that you can find in a city across the country. I mean, who are the customers?
The customers are the sheriffs that work there, the employees and all the staff. We have counselors out there, other educators. The lawyers come out there too that are visiting. But that's really our customer base. And it was important to me when we were designing the cafe to make it feel like a third wave cafe. It, you know, this is a sanctuary for not only these women, but for me and the other trainer, Allison Bizarik, and the staff out there, it's just a little piece of, you know, not jail.
Yeah. Given that this is a newer vocational program at Rio Cosumnes, was this emulated off similar programs at other correctional facilities?
It wasn't. But then I had discovered another one. I go down rabbit holes. So I discovered another program in London, and they were Redemption Roasters, where they started in a facility and then they grew outside the facility and they help a number of people. That's my goal.
Walk us through the training that students go through.
We go through, it's like a three-part process, and it's just the barista skills. But when I get a new student, you know, we just go through a coffee history lesson, kind of like a coffee 101, like, and then different, like, kind of bean to cup, and then different, we go back to certain things like, say, coffee processing. Each level we dive just a little bit deeper. And then in the stage two, we start with latte art. But that also,
like, the little hearts and the shapes on top of a latte.
Tulips, rosettas. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But then I get excited about the science behind it. Legends over there. Just like I love milk science and, you know, anything coffee science related. So we're going into the, you know, well, how is it that we can do this design? You know, let's get, you know, to the nitty gritty. So they not only know how to pour these, but they understand why.
Mm. That's wonderful. And Legend, that brings me to you. You're an alumna of Redemption Coffee. How did you come to learn of the barista program?
Well, going through the situation that I was going through, knowing that I had a significant amount of time that I was going to be at RCCC, I started looking into the different programs that they had available, because with the criminal background that I eventually ended up having, I couldn't go back into the work that I used to do. So I was looking for new skills. Initially, I looked into the welding and the construction. However, those are more geared towards the men. Officer Takeda, he came to me and he asked me how I felt about Redemption Coffee. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm trying to do whatever it takes to get me back to my children as fast as possible. So I did that, and I also did the beekeeping program as well as the custodial. So I did all of them. But most of my time I spent with Jamie and Allison. And what got me fully interested in it was learning the history behind where coffee originated. Finding out that it originated in Ethiopia, like, struck a chord with me. And then along those lines, I started asking, well, I know I don't want to be a barista. I have fun doing it, but I don't want to be a barista for something to do as a living wage. That's not what I wanted to do. So she mentioned the company Bewley's, and that they have roasters and they roast coffee. And that's where my interest went into the science behind the roasting, and how do they know how long to roast it to make it taste like this. And when I started with Jamie, coffee tastes like coffee. It smelled like coffee. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I now can pick out flavor notes. I can tell you if it's been burnt or if it's been open, if it's fermented, you know, based off of the different flavors and smells and things like that it gives off. She is a wonderful mentor. She is, for whatever is going to help us be successful, she does her absolute best to make sure leaving and even after, she tries to keep up with you and make sure that everything is going okay. And she's awesome. If it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have been at Bewley's. If I didn't know anything about Redemption Coffee, I don't think I would have had such a peaceful time at RCCC, because it gave me somewhere to put my energy, somewhere to focus on, something to, I don't want to risk losing being able to get out of the dorm to go do this, to go see, because the area is very beautiful. You see green grass. You're not seeing cages and, you know, things like that. It is more so like you are away from RCCC when you're at Redemption Coffee.
Yeah, and hearing from you, I mean, prior to Redemption Coffee, I mean, it was kind of difficult figuring out the next steps in your life, you know, once you were going to be released from RCCC Rio Cosumnes, but you found Redemption Coffee, and that gave you a pathway, and it gave you really a time to also, during your training, to pause and to just kind of pause with yourself, which is so difficult to do for any of us. When you look back on your time there, like during that training, are there particularly special moments that you hold on to?
Well, every day is a special day when you work with Jamie, because there's no telling what, you know, our conversations we could have with her in complete and utter confidence, as long as we weren't saying we were going to harm ourselves or anything like that. So we were able to talk about us, what's going on, without fear of it being used against us. So that was always really, really good. And the fact that, you know, regardless of how tired she was, her and Allison, they always did their best to make sure that we were treated as employees and not inmates. You know, that was one of the main reasons why I stayed in the Redemption Coffee program so long, was her words to us was, you guys are employees when you're here. You're not inmates, you're not prisoners, and the officers are going to treat you as such, you know. So that was one of the main things.
I would imagine you also learned skills that can be applied outside of the coffee industry.
Well, yeah, I'm career customer service. So people skills and learning how to manage things are something that I do. And I'm a single mother of five. So I multitask very well. But there are a lot of things like I learned how to fix espresso machines. And work on, we've learned how to think outside the box to come up with different stuff. It's amazing the different stuff that you'll learn as a barista, but it doesn't stop there. Jamie's program goes all the way up. It teaches you how to order supplies, how to manage a small coffee shop or even a bigger coffee shop. It goes all the way up there. It doesn't just stop at the barista level.
Yeah, so. You're going from the science of it to the economics of it to the logistics of it to even the creativity of it as well, and seeing what fits you the best and if you want to apply that to your life once that you were released. And you did. I mean, you landed a role at Bewley's North America in their roastery. What does that mean to you? What do you do there?
So I do a little bit of everything. I'm still learning. I have been released from RCCC since the 17th of November, so it's going on almost 3 months. And Bewley's hired me, knowing my background, knowing all of that. I'm technically a pack operator / roaster. And I'm just learning more about the Bewley's company and how we run everything so that I can make this a longevity, because they gave me a shot when I know other people would not have.
And this is a key component. It's not just training students with skills so that once they're released, it's like, okay, well, you're on your own. Go look for a job in the coffee industry. This program, this vocational program, is also connecting students with potential employers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, and I'm not the only one that Jamie and Redemption Coffee has been able to do this for. I personally have seen Jamie and the Redemption Coffee program help other women get into positions that they're looking for, whether it be in a barista or even if they need help going in a different direction, getting more training. Jamie is always available to help look up information. We applied for a program, the PACE NKG program, while I was still incarcerated, because it's a paid training on everything coffee, how to be a quality control Q grader. You know, so she's whatever is going to help us be as successful as possible.
That's wonderful. You know, part of this is the name, you know, Redemption Coffee. And a key word in that, obviously, is redemption. I mean, Legend, do you feel the meaning of that word while going through this program and reflecting on your time with this program?
Well, yeah, because through the program, you learn, especially with me, being as old as I was and getting in trouble, you know, making a mistake, I was like, oh, I'm a felon. This is what I kept saying. It was a way to motivate myself to do better as well, because I know I need to have different skills. But going through the program, what was given back to me was, you're not a felon. You have a felony background. You are not. I heard this all the time. You are not a felon. You have a felony background, which made me think, like, you know what? That's right. And so, instead of looking at it in a negative content, I can now look at it in a positive content. And roundabout, Bewley's helps that too, because they're like, okay, yeah, we see that you have a background. We're going to give you a shot and see what you do with it from here.
That's so true. That's kind of, I mean, not just for our program, you're not a felon, you have a felony. Mm-hmm. What I mean, that's the officers out there, the reentry team, who are such an integral part to what I do out there. They're such a support, and they don't get enough, I guess, recognition for what they do.
And but they keep up with you for a year after. You know, it's the reentry program is very good for people who want to make use of it and make the best out of it. It worked for me, and I'm happy to be here. I told Jamie anything that she needs, I'll be right here.
You know, Jamie, what have students like Legend taught you?
Oh, that I don't know it all, that that I can regain another sense of purpose. These women have reignited not only my passion in coffee, but a passion I had no idea that was inside of me to kind of pay it forward or do something more with this industry that has cradled me for so long.
Yeah. I mean, you went from starting when it was just an idea to building the curriculum, actually putting it into practice and seeing results in people's lives like legend. I mean, what has this journey meant to you? It's just really beginning.
Oh, it is just beginning because there's so much more to do. And I have to step back sometimes because I get so excited about things. And I have grown so much more as a trainer through these women and learning their stories and actually being able to talk about my stories too with them. I mean, it's, you know, it's a great feeling.
Legend, I mean, this came at a time when you were at our Triple C. I mean, if Redemption Coffee didn't exist, how do you think your time and your life after, once you were released, how it would have been different?
It definitely would have been a lot tougher. I don't fold very quickly, but I was out on the 17th, and that Monday I had my interview, and that following Monday I started working. I wouldn't have been able to find a job that paid me enough to make sure that I caught up on my bills and, you know, all of that in time enough to avoid, you know, detrimental situations. So the Redemption program definitely did help me out, and it helped keep my mind busy. It helped provide an oasis away from all of the hectic that's going on. You imagine living in a pod with 70 women, but they're behaving as if they're in middle school. You know, it becomes redundant. So to be able to actually leave and be gone from that for 8 hours a day or more, it gives you a kind of peace to be able to sit and focus on what you need to do next.
Legend and Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Jamie Mason is the program director of Redemption Coffee, a program offered to women incarcerated at Rio Sumnis Correctional Center in Sacramento County that trains students in specialty coffee and connects them with the coffee industry. And Legend Highwater is an alumna of the program and now works as a roaster at Bewley's North America. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Valentine's Day is tomorrow. For some, it's a night out. For others, it's a quiet night at home. But either way, it is an opportunity for wine, food, and music to all come together. But it can also be a little bit stressful. So we're going to have a little bit of fun today, and we have called on two of our favorites to help take the stress out of all of the planning with the best wine and the best music to pair with Valentine's Day. We have wine expert Rick Cushman, as well as CAP Radio's classical musical host, Jennifer Reason. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning.
You both are the perfect blend, you know, to lead into the holidays. We did this over the holidays in December. We're doing it again for Valentine's Day. You know, Rick, before we get to the fun stuff, I mean, we had a pretty severe series of storms that moved through Northern California. What impact, what, if any, was on the wine industry in late December through January?
Fundamentally, all good. I mean, there was, you know, a little bit of vineyard damage, like with a lot of ag, but the timing couldn't have been better because mostly grapevines are dormant. But the good part was, you know, the grapevines, to go sideways for a moment, you know, grapevines survived the drought a little better than a lot of other crops, in part because when they struggle, you get smaller yields and maybe smaller grapes, but more intense wines. But that's only good for so long. And after a while, the vines really start to feel it. And so, one, this gave them a refresh. But probably even more important is it washed the salts out of the soil. And this is always a thing that, you know, we sort of not don't think about. But when we there isn't a lot of water, or when well water is used, and especially when the wells are low and, you know, it needs to be refreshed, is that you start to recycle salts from the ground into the lands. And so this really cleaned them out. It also was sort of refreshed for the cover crops, which, you know, help. And so all in all, in pretty good shape. Now, the next thing is, so, you know, they'll start to bud coming up in, you know, March and April, and that's when they're really vulnerable to storms. So if a storm came a little later or freeze came a little later, it could be very damaging. But so timing was perfect. And frankly, like most of California, you know, we survived the damage and now fingers crossed that we have enough water to get by for at least a little while.
Yeah. Well, that is good news to hear, you know, because there was a lot of damage and destruction, you know, in January. Yeah. But it's good to hear that the wine industry fared relatively well. So when it comes to wine, music, all things Valentine's Day, you know, I reflexively think of like wine and chocolates as all-time go-tos, but you're not really a fan of that, right?
I am not. I am a fan of wine. I am a fan of chocolate, just separately. You know, I was building on that Morning Edition segment about, savor it. But the truth of it is, like, red wine and chocolate don't pair well. Now, if we've been told this, and so you've been told so many times, like everything else, if you hear it, you go, oh, it must be great. And then you, oh, yeah, sure, it's good. But the truth of it is, there's a lot of acid in wine. And you don't think of it that way. But I say this, always think about like things where there are acid that you don't think about. Orange juice, right? Orange juice, you don't think, gee, there's acid in there until you brush your teeth and then drink your orange juice. Same thing. And the chocolate, the sweetness in the chocolate makes the red wine taste sour. So what you do is you go with sweet wines, you know, port style wines and Rieslings and dessert wines. Many of our friends up in the foothills are really big on that because it can get them ripe. And so there's that a piece of chocolate and a sweet wine. Heaven, absolute heaven.
How do you suggest people start the evening? I would imagine maybe some bubbly.
Always bubbly. Well, and you know, that's kind of a thing with any celebration, as Jennifer well knows. For a lot of us going out, if you're going out on Tuesday night, is maybe not the biggest night, right? But there are going to be people going out, and you might have to go to the bar and must have to hang out a little bit. And what would you get, Jennifer?
Bubbles, without question.
Absolutely. I think it just adds such a celebratory tone, and it's just, you know, and bubbles are almost by definition romantic. And one suggestion, by the way, if you're home and you've opened up a bottle of sparkling, don't put it in a flute. Put it in a wine glass, a regular wine glass, if you have a white wine glass. And the flutes are beautiful, and that's why people put them in flutes, because it shows the bubbles. And in fact, in nice flutes, they have a little notch at the bottom of the glass so that those bubbles come straight up. I'm waving my hands because we're on radio, and so it's important to be able to see my hand movement here. But the truth of it is, you can taste it better if you put it in a regular wine glass.
I never knew that.
Yeah, and if you go, doing wine tastings, or you go to wine regions, they'll taste you in large wine glasses.
Hmm. All right, Jennifer, we're going to do some pairing with some music. What do you have for us?
Well, to go with your bubbles, possibly one of the most romantic pieces of classical music ever, it's called Salut d'Amour. It's by a wonderful British composer named Edward Elgar, and he was courting his hopefully soon to be fiance Alice, and decided to propose to her with this very piece of music.
We're all swaying right now.
Yeah. I know.
I'd say yes.
I mean, it would be an immediate yes, right?
Yeah, it would be an immediate yes. Okay, well, so Rick, I'm on that note, maybe some people are going to like pop the big question. What kind of tips do you have?
Well, just one quick thing on that, because we were talking earlier, and the composer is British. And interesting thing is that, you know, England is now, the Brits are developing a champagne or a sparkling wine.
Oh.
Because as global warming continues, they've actually now have the capacity to grow grapevines. And it's similar in both weather and even in soils to the Champagne region. but they don't have anything they can really call it. There's not a name. Like Champagne is the region, so it has to be French Champagne. So the word that seems to be going around is fizz.
Fizz.
Yeah, so much for the sophistication.
So yeah, like Prosecco, you obviously have California sparkling wine, and now potentially fizz when you head to the UK.
So I have one and a half romantic tips, and those are all I have. Like, so the romantic tip is this. If you are going to dinner, and you might have to wait a bit, but when you call ahead to the restaurant and say, when we sit down, I would like you to bring my partner a glass of sparkling wine. And, you know, and by the way, ladies, do that for your guys, too, because guys never expect anything because we don't really think you like us. So, you know, that will be a shock, too. I think that's just a really nice romantic touch. However, speaking of proposals, please don't hide the ring in the food or the wine glass, because choking just isn't that romantic.
Yeah, I've seen so many, unfortunate fail videos of proposals gone wrong, right? And taking a turn for the worse, despite all the best intentions.
Yeah.
You know, so for people who are more adventurous when it comes to wine, what do you recommend they do? Do you recommend like kind of skipping the bottle and just getting a couple glasses?
Well, you know, so that's the cool thing about holidays or big days is it could be, you know, that really special bottle night. Or one of the things is it is a little bit more expensive, but like go for wine by the glass. And, you know, you can each, you know, get different glasses, I mean, different wines, and then you can, you know, share and taste back and forth and talk about it. And I think one of the notes about Valentine's Day meals and wine and classical music is savor it. It's always like go slow. Find reasons to go slow and to think about it. And that's one of the things I really like about getting a couple of different wines is it makes you think a little bit about what this wine tastes like, what the food tastes like, why you are so happy to be with your partner there at the table, all those sorts of things.
A good time to pause and reflect and appreciate the person that's sitting across from you.
Absolutely. I'm always happy that my wife is willing to go out with me. So I think that's it's a good moment.
When we think about Valentine's Day, Jennifer, we also think of obviously romance, maybe like sexing it up a little bit. What kind of music do you have to for that sultry mood?
Well, for the sultry mood, one that appropriately named Romance. So this is by Robert Schumann, and it was for another woman who is yet to be asked to be married, Clara, but her father was in the way. He said, no, I don't like this man, absolutely not. So he's communicating to her that, no, I really love you, and we're going to make this happen, but through this piece of music.
Approval we need is each other's, right?
Amen.
Wow.
Amen.
That is beautiful.
It is.
Isn't
wonderful.
It gorgeous? It's breathtaking.
What kind of dessert wines maybe would you pair with this, right?
Well, that's, you know, I was just thinking, what goes with this? And we had talked earlier, Jennifer and I, but I think actually what it absolutely was perfect is because there's such a richness and a depth to that is an old sweet Riesling, you know, and it's like, you'll find it called, it's Biren Oslas, which means, I think it's very select. They're sweet, they're deep, there's layers of flavor to it, there's a mellowness to it, and it'll go really well with chocolate.
Rick and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky.
We'll do this for the next holiday.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, and, you know, I'm ready for it.
I think we should just go pair some wine and music sometime, Jennifer.
Hey, let's do it.
It's a deal.
I love it. I'm here for it. Rick Cushman is our wine expert, and Jennifer Reason, of course, is Cap Radio's classical musical host. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a fantastic day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.